Hello, everyone, and welcome to our webinar, VentureLaw Meetup Series webinar for February 2020. This month, we are doing Understanding Venture Capital Term Sheets. And with me this month is my colleague, Danielle Assad. So as many of you know or have met me, my name is Leah Brownlee. I'm of counsel in the corporate group at Squire Patton Boggs. I work in the Cleveland office. And for the most part, I work with early stage to mid-stage companies or investors in those companies. And so this is actually one of my areas of expertise, although I host a number of other topics through this forum. And then I'll let Danielle also introduce herself.
Thanks, Kia. Hello, everyone. My name is Danielle Assad, and I am an M&A lawyer in the corporate practice group at Squire Patton Boggs, based in Cleveland. I mainly represent private equity investors, and I'm hoping today to share with you the investor's perspective on term sheets so that to help you the next time you're negotiating a term sheet for your business.
Yes. So thank you, Danielle. So notably, I'm going to be the company counsel today. Danielle's going to be more the investor counsel, so you might have some contrary positions because that's what happens when you're negotiating a term sheet, that some of the positions are, there's always a term that's much more friendly for the company versus the investor and the negotiation power of how you get to an agreement. So just a quick thank you to our co-sponsors. We have a number of local organizations, some of which have national chapters, but 14 in total now that kind of help promote this event and also provide subject matter expertise for the webinar and our live event that also is associated with this. So just to set the stage, today we're going to talk about a number of things, and we've created an outline today to kind of set the stage to go through them. So first, the stages of the company's growth and funding lifecycle, the types of venture capital investors, and then we'll dive into the term sheet and the various terms of that, and then what happens following the signing of the term sheet, and touch a little bit on that. This is fairly dense material, so please feel free to post questions or follow up with us with questions during the webinar, and we'll do our best respond to them as soon as we receive them. So as a company grows, there's a mark set where it is in its stage of development. So we go from the early stage of development where it receives generally funding either from the founder's bank accounts, there are personal savings, there are friends and family, and also super angels, which are kind of high net worth individuals that have a personal interest in investing in that specific technology that may be willing to take the risk up front to invest their dollars. And after they get past that development stage and really get into a proof of concept for a product, they typically enter into the venture capital stage of development, or the area where venture capital will invest. And that's, a set of stages that start with what is called the seed stage of a company and progress through early, mid, and later stages where those align with investment rounds, from a seed investment round to Series A, Series B, Series C, and sometimes further on in investment rounds. And while the company is in those stages, it's really refining its product, it's refining its business plan, it's creating traction in the marketplace. Typically early on, whether it's at seed stage or in the first stages, it's a revenue positive company. It may be getting a few million dollars of revenue in. And the things that I'm talking about now are kind of the check marks that the venture capitalists look like look at to determine whether that company is at the stage where it's an investable company for the venture capitalist. And that's typically called the investment thesis of the venture capitalist, and that's how we're categorizing those companies is through the eyes of the investor. So when the investor looks at the company, where is it within the stage of development? And then post-venture capital stage, it really is a continuum, but you go into the bigger, more established companies that may be bought by private equity investors, may go through different types of financing that are much bigger, more sophisticated financing. And so, you know, going from that stage of the company and then talking about the funding life cycle, if you're looking at the slides, we have an image up there that kind of slots this into columns of who invests at what stage, and you'll see a staircase of the venture capital stages starting at seed level and going up to C level, showing that the company is creating more revenue as it's going through this stage of development where venture capitalists are interested in investing dollars in it. But at each subsequent stage, it's presumed to be a more developed and more revenue-positive company. And you'll particularly note that the seed stage is not at zero or negative revenue. Very oftentimes, we see even late-stage angel investors asking for companies to have revenue before their investment dollars come in.
Yeah, that's right, Leah. Depending on the type of the industry that the company is in, this, the revenue line may be different. So this is just we just wanted to give you an example of what it would look like.
Right, and I think I was talking about a non-regulated product. I know often lots of life science companies will not be at that revenue positive stage for many, many years into their existence and into their development, just because of the regulatory environment that they live within.
And then we wanted to differentiate the types of venture capital investors for you. There are mainly three kinds. First is the seed stage investors. These are the investors that come in and try to help a company get started and try to get to positive revenues. The early stage investors, these come in and help a company that's been able to prove itself in the concept stage, and they help with accelerated sales and provide capital for equipment, for example, and marketing efforts. And then the growth stage investors, they help a company that's really ready to grow and just needs the capital and investment, the capital and investment to continue growing.
And do you have any examples of who those investors might be? So I'll give you, on the seed stage, often at least in the state of Ohio, we see that the state might have established different funds that will invest at the seed level.
Yeah, that's right. So certain investors will say that, look, we're only investing in startups, or some of them will say, no, we only will invest in a company that's really rapidly growing. And so it just depends on the type of fund that's been established and what their comfort level is when it comes to risk and investing.
Yeah, and I would say, you know, as you're approaching venture capitalists, one of the initial questions to have is using kind of the magic words of what is their investment thesis. That's not standard terminology outside of the venture capital world, but it is really how they define who they think is an investable company. And as a company going to look for an investment, that's a very important thing to know very early on in the discussions to understand if they're even a potential investor in your company.
That's right. And so this is why we initially describe the growth cycle of a company, so that you need to know where your company is on that line, so that you know the type of investors that will approach you or the ones that you want to approach, so you're contacting the right people and not just wasting your time and efforts. A lot of times we see something called club deals where a lead investor will take the time and will negotiate with the founders of a business or a company. This lead investor will do the diligence and come up with a valuation, and then negotiate a term sheet and commit to fund some amount of capital. Then the company will take its term sheet with the lead investor and get more investors to follow on the same terms. So this is what is called a club deal. And it's usually helpful for the company to follow that sort of structure, because ultimately the company is going to reimburse the lead investor for its due diligence and costs in funding the capital once the capital is funded. And so it's more efficient and less costly to deal with one lead investor than multiple investors at the same time. And so how do these VC investors structure their investments? They will provide cash for the issuance of a new class of preferred stock. And this preferred stock will come with special certain rights that typically the founders don't have, or other common holders like management, for example. And these rights are really protective rights, even if the investor is going to own a minority interest in the business. And the main type of protective right that these preferred stocks come with is something called a liquidation preference. And liquidation preference, what it means is when the company is eventually sold, or it has an initial public offering, or in the worst case scenario, it has to be dissolved in bankruptcy, these VC investors will get paid first before any of the other shareholders get paid, including the founders who started the company. This is the downside protection for these investors to take on the risks involved with investing with startups or early stage companies. So as I said before, it's really important for you to know what stage your business is in the growth cycle, and why you're raising venture capital instead of getting another source of capital, because of the trade-offs, which is, you know, you're bringing in an outside investor to get funding, and you're giving up certain equity and certain rights. So you've really got to know that this is what you need for your business at this time.
Right. And that's key, is before taking any money, whether it's, you know, sitting down with a whiteboard and making sure that your plan for your business is the same as your investor's plan for your business, because if they're not, you're going to have problems in the future, because they may want to get their money back before you expect to sell the business. They may want you to focus on one product where you have five great ideas and you think you have a platform company. There's different reasons why the vision may not align, but the investor will be less helpful for the company if their vision does not align with yours when you take their money. And another just quick note to make on the structure of the investments. In the U.S., this is not a free-for-all, design it however you want thing. We have a generally accepted structure in the U.S. that almost everybody uses. And a really good resource and free resource for people to look at for what that structure is the National Venture Capital Association. You can go to their website. They have lots of resources. But they standardize a lot of what the documents that we use in these investment transactions are.
Okay. So let's say you decided that venture capital is what you need for your company, and they say to you, okay, look, we're going to give you a term sheet or a letter of intent, and you're wondering what that is. And a term sheet is the key document in this negotiation process. It's going through the process of preparing and negotiating a term sheet with the investor will help to solidify the transaction and to create a sense of momentum between you and the investors. So it's the first step in any transaction is to agree on the most important terms. A term sheet or a letter of intent should not be binding, and it's typically not binding except for certain sections. There should not be an obligation to fund capital because the investor will need time to do their diligence, their business diligence, their legal diligence, any other checks that they need to do on your company. And you and the investor have to agree on the final documents that will be signed. So this is why it's not a binding agreement to provide the money. But there are certain sections that will typically be binding, and those are confidentiality. You would want the investor to maintain the confidentiality of your business information. They may also want you to maintain confidentiality about them speaking with you. Sometimes the investor will say, okay, I need you to give me a 30-day period to do my diligence and prepare the final documents. And during this 30-day period, you will not approach anyone else. You will not talk to anyone else. And so it's an exclusive negotiation period, and that tends to be binding. And then finally is the payment of expenses. As I mentioned, the company will typically reimburse the investor for its legal fees and other diligence fees as long as the funding goes through. A well-drawn-out and complete term sheet, it will facilitate the drafting of the final documents for the lawyers, and it will minimize the time and effort to draft these documents. From our experience, even though it's a non-binding agreement, we find that it's unusual for the actual deal and the final documents to vary significantly from what was agreed in the term sheet. So it's important for you to, if there's something that you're concerned about or a specific condition or covenant that you want in there, you should include it in this term sheet and don't say, well, I'll leave it for when we do the final documents. It's better to deal with it at this time and not later on when you've invested a lot of time and effort in the final documents.
Right. And I think the other thing to note is if you haven't done a number of investment deals, and even if you have, if you're not the expert in these documents or you feel like you could benefit from outside counsel, you should be engaging counsel early. So oftentimes, and probably more often than not, from my side as company counsel, I will get a signed term sheet before as the first document in the lead-in to starting a deal. And what that means to me is that I can't have much business advice to the client on what's the standard term because they've already agreed to something that has been put in front of them, and we need to work with what has been agreed to, rather than being able to give them advice as far as what may be more friendly to the company or more applicable to them in their industry and their specific situation. So there is value definitely in engaging counsel earlier to give input on how that term sheet is structured. And notably, you know, as you're going to get money, we know that means you might not have much money. to pay the council. So it is a trade-off, and it's, you know, and you may be thinking, how can I spend the legal dollars, you know, on hiring counsel when I don't have a signed term sheet yet and I don't know that I have a deal yet. So it is a fine line to work, to walk, but we know that just as well as you do, and we can work with you and make things very efficient and advise you, so, you know, appropriately. We don't need to, you know, take the wheel and start steering at the term sheet level. We can spend very little time and give value if that's what's needed for your budget.
That's right. And then the other thing, when you take the time to actually review a term sheet with outside counsel, you will sort of signal to the investor that you are very serious about who you're bringing in and why you're bringing them in, and what your expectation is, that you're just not, you know, again, assign whatever is put in front of you because this is your business and you care about it so much and that's the way you run it. And so remember, this is what you're signaling to them. If they just put something in front of you and you just sign it, it's sort of a red flag. So what goes in a term sheet? There are three main categories. Each term sheet is unique to the business. I've heard investors tell the company that, oh, this is our standard form term sheet. Other investors, other companies have agreed to it. While the term sheet will have, like, its three main categories of sections, it is not standard, and you should really think about what's important for you, what's important for your business, what your vision is, and you know, what you see happening in the future with this new partner that you're bringing on. So the main, there are three, like I said, types of sections. First is the economic terms. These are, this is when the type of security, like a preferred stock, is described, how much is its price per share, what the valuation of the company is, liquidation preference, and other terms. And then the control terms are the approval rights that this investor is going to get, and then other rights such as anti-dilution, participation, if they're going to get any information rights, which we'll get into. And then finally, the last type of term is the exit term, which is how are they going to get their money back? Are they going to have a drag-along co-sale rights or some sort of IPO registration rights? So we'll get into this each section next.
So jumping into the economic terms, from an overarching basis, this is the driver for the term sheet. You're going out and asking for money. You have a specific amount of money that your business needs to reach the goals that you've set for the business before you raise more money. And you most likely have an idea about how much of your business that you want to sell in order to get that money. And so driving from that, we get to the price per share. Price per share assumes a corporation, not an LLC, but the same, conceptually, it can work for either entity type. And so we take maybe what is a standard, we're going to sell 20% of the company, and we figure out for 20% of the company, you want to raise, you know, $1 million, and then you do a math problem, in essence, to figure out what your value is. If 20% of your company is $1 million, you're worth $5 million, and work it out backwards. And that's the valuation. So I just did a very simple one. There's a story that goes in behind the valuation that supports what that number is. It's not just I need money, and therefore my that's what my valuation is. It's a story of this is what my market is, this is how much of the market I'm going to be able to capture, this is how far away I am from reaching that market and capturing it, and how much money it's going to take me to get there. And so that valuation is called an enterprise valuation. And that enterprise valuation is typically built by the business people at the company, and to the extent they have outside advisors commenting on that valuation, the outside advisors are usually accountants helping to create some structure around that story that's backing up the valuation of their company. And there's other inputs as well. What do other companies that look like me typically sell for? And when I said it's not just how much money do you need, that's also an input. Do you need your valuation to be $10 million? Because that's, you know, since it is a fairly flexible storyline that you're building, you can have a goal that you're going towards to create the value. But you determine your value in a venture round, and you agree with that value with the investor. So how much is this company worth? And that's one of the very first negotiations. Once the investor has kind of seriously started discussions with you. Because you need to ensure that you're on the same, you can reach an agreement on the value, or else we're not going to reach an agreement on any other terms. And I want to back up a minute, at least if you're looking at the slide. I started with value, and there's a reason I did that is because in the stages of the company, the first time that you really holistically agree to a value of your company is at the first venture financing stage. The prior stages typically use different types of securities that don't require the value to be agreed to. And that would be a simple agreement for future equity, which is called a SAFE, or a convertible note. And those securities, to a large extent, kick the can down the road. And they are simpler to negotiate. They don't require kind of that value agreement up front. They just require the kind of agreement that this is interesting, there's potential to make money off it from investors, and the company needs money before they can get to this stage of development where they can, you know, attract venture investment and really value their company. So lots of investors exist in that early round that are willing to risk their money for the potential of getting, you know, 100x return in 7-10 years. And that's the story you sell them at the earlier stages. A quick reference, we did a valuation presentation, and we'll send out a link to that valuation presentation that we did last year that goes into a lot more depth on what the value, how you get to the value of the company. Other terms that impact economics. Danielle earlier referenced the liquidation preference. So that is the order in which, when you sell the company, the investors in the company get their money back. So that's a very, very important economic term to the investor coming back, coming into your company, because they want to reach an agreement where it makes sense for them to put the money at risk that they're putting into your company, because they're going to get, based on their calculation, a certain return on investment in 3 years or 5 years or 7 years, and they're more certain to get that return because they're getting their money first before other investors are. The next economic term is the capitalization of the company. So I said you're selling 20% of your company as an example. That's negotiable. How much of your company are you selling? And you walk through what that capitalization table looks like, which is really an Excel table that lists all of the shareholders and how many shares each of them own. And you figure out, you know, how many shares that new investor is going to own or going to buy when they're going in. And that table is going to be really, really important for negotiation purposes and understanding how you're affecting the power balance in the company by the number that you agree to with that investor coming in that they're going to buy. So a quick example on the valuation side, and this is, this shows the differential of how much of the cap table that they buy. A legal term that you're going to see is called fully diluted basis. So the investor invests in the stock on a fully diluted basis, and this includes all shares currently issued and all stock options or kind of incentive equity that's been granted and oftentimes reserved to be granted to employees of the company. So in this example, you have an investor coming in at $1 million into a company that there's an agreed upon valuation of $10 million. They have 900,000 shares issued, 100,000 shares reserved for stock options. And so we look at what power that VC investor is buying with $1 million. So on a fully diluted basis, basic math, they get 9.09% of the stock of the company. So that's shares plus stock options plus the new shares issued. That's going to be their ownership. But when I say power, I mean voting power. So the items that shareholders have to vote for, they get 10% of that power because stock options don't vote.
Right. And speaking of cap table, if you've sort of been neglecting your cap table, not keeping track of the options you may have issued under employment agreements, this is the time to clean things up and just make sure everything is documented because the investor will want to see your cap table and we'll ask questions, and we want to verify each item on that cap table, so this is the time to really clean up anything that has to be cleaned up.
And a secondary reason with regard to stock options from a value to your employees reason, the moment you get money into the company, your company's worth more money, and there's a tax consequence that's associated with the value of your company. And so usually you want the value to be lower when you're giving options or stock to employees because then they have a lower tax that they ultimately have to pay. So I mentioned the fully diluted basis as this legal term that you're going to hear a lot. This is a contested point in negotiations. So the question is this all of the issued stock options, or is this all of the stock options reserved to be issued, plus all of the issued stock options? As you can see, we just ran through some simple math, but that will matter for how much of the company that $1 million ends up buying. In that, you know, when we're talking about economics, it all boils back to it's a math problem, and depending on what the ultimate answer to each of the math problems is, that drives the amount of power that stockholder is buying.
That's right. And the reason this is important because, say you have set aside 10% of your shares to be issued for stock options, but these stock options are will only have value if certain things happen, such as the company reaches a certain revenue level or a product is launched. And so there may be criteria for the options to vest. And so the company will say to the investor, why should we include these options when we don't even know if they will even have any value in the future? Why should we include them in, you know, what would be the fully diluted number of shares? So So this is where it becomes sort of contentious, and there's some back and forth on this point.
Yeah, and so in the presentation, we have some negotiating points for both investor and company on that point.
So then we get to liquidation preference, which we've described earlier. In the term sheet, you'll see something called a liquidity event, which could be any number of things that could happen to a company, such as a majority interest of the company is sold or a majority of its assets are sold. It has an initial public offering, or in the unfortunate event, in the unfortunate situation where it has to file for bankruptcy and really dissolve. So these come under something called a liquidity event. And when a liquidity event happens, the investors who hold the preferred stock, they get their preference and get paid first before anyone else gets paid. So the investors who hold preferred stock get the greater of either their preference or what they would have received had they converted their preferred stock into common stock. That's always something they expect. And so every time you have a round of capital raising, so you have an A, a B, and a C, each investor coming in later will be paid first. So the C will be paid first, then the B, then the A. And so when the A are negotiating with you and they're asking for really unreasonable terms, you can always say to them that, look, this is our Series A. We expect to grow even more and raise more capital in the future. And imagine what the next investor at the B level is going to ask for if you're asking for these unreasonable terms. So that's one thing you can remind them of, is that, look, this is where we are in the growth of the company, and you need to be reasonable in what you're asking.
And one thing to note, if you're negotiating one of the later rounds, if you have multiple steps, doing kind of modeling the sheet of how a payout at a certain scale value of the company will look is a really important tool prior to taking the money, because what you're doing when you're doing that is making sure that if you sell the company for a given amount of money that the investor thinks you can sell for, each of the investors are getting out what they expect to get out. And those expectations are ultimately driving the terms of the documents that get signed.
Yeah. And then there are three types of preferred stock that we see in term sheets. These are in order of harshness. The first one is non-participating preferred, then cap participating preferred, and finally uncapped participating preferred, which is really, really rare. I've never seen it in my experience, and so it's very rare to ask for it. On the next page, we've described how each of these would be written in a term sheet. Basically, not participating means the preferred gets paid first, then the remainder is distributed among the common stockholders. The cap participating preferred means the preferred still gets paid first, and then they participate with the common up to a certain cap. And then the uncapped means there is no cap as to how much they can participate with the common.
Right. And just a quick note, if you're looking at the slide, you'll see the picture. A legal term of art that we use, this is called the waterfall. So when people keep on saying, what does the waterfall look like, this is what they mean.
Yeah. And then in the next slide, we're running out of time, so we'll just keep we'll go quickly. But this is an example of what the end result would be if you give if you have different types of preferred stock. So you can see what each result for each type of stock is see. And then the other economic terms that may be in a term sheet, capitalization, we talked about the cap table and having it cleaned up. The investor may want to negotiate certain items or say to you that, look, you need to convert these types of shares or so on. Sometimes the term sheet will describe if any dividends are going to be paid to the investor. Cumulative dividends, there are two kinds. There's cumulative, which is dividends that automatically accrue. The board doesn't have to approve them. They just happen automatically. Non-cumulative means they will only accrue and be paid if the board of directors declares these dividends.
Right, and this it's really important if you're going back before you agree to anything and modeling how the payments upon a sale of the company work, to understand how the dividends work if you have an investor acting for dividends, because it can have a significant difference on how much the common stockholders ultimately receive if you sell the company.
And then we talked about reimbursing the investor expenses. Then we get to control terms.
Yeah, so we're done with the economics. Everybody's in agreement with the valuation of the company. You agree how people are going to get paid and how much people are going to get paid if the exit is what you expect it to be, and you think that there's value for everybody in this proposition, and the investor agrees with you. Next thing we do is we talk about how the investor can impose control on the company to ensure that it can have a say in retaining that value that it thinks is there in the company. So we start with the special investor approval rights. This means that the company cannot do certain things without asking permission, in essence, from the investor that just came on. And these are going to be big things. They cannot sell the company, merge the company with another company, or have a different fundamental change to the business. So you're changing the value proposition for the investor, and they want to stay in that. You can't amend your foundational documents. This is different in that you're not changing what the business is doing. You're changing the rules of the company when you do the amendment, and you can actually change some of the economic terms that investor has negotiated if you're allowed to make this change without the investor's input. And so the investor wants to have a say and really restrict you from making a change before it happens. And you cannot create or issue additional stock, and this drives towards the economics as well. So if somebody else is going to get paid when you sell the company, that investor wants to have a say in who that somebody else is and what the terms of that investment are, and so they'll want to vote on that. And then there's, you know, other protective provisions that are fairly standardized that allow the investor to vote to protect their investment. Really do a reality check on these. There has to be a reason behind the general protective terms. It can't just be that they want to micromanage you. It needs to make sense for your business, and it has to have a good business rationale for protecting the investor. So make sure you understand this. The next area, they're going to want a board seat, and that is so that they can keep a watch on the company. They want to be in the boardroom. They want to have a vote. They want to know what's going on at the company fairly frequently so they can manage what's going on and see how their investment is progressing. And they're going to dedicate, you know, a portion of a person that works at the investor to their time to help manage their investment. That's one of their costs of investing, is spending time and really paying attention. And so they're going to ask for that. At any investment level, you really shouldn't be agreeing to more than one board seat. Oftentimes, we see more than one being requested, and we may suggest that one of those board seats should be an observer, which means they're allowed to come to the boardroom, but their vote doesn't count when the board votes. And that's usually good enough for if you have, you know, two big investors coming in, the lead will take a board seat, and then the second will take an observer seat. And then you have director rights. So these are lower-level rights than the shareholder rights, but they are usually still big things, you know, hiring, firing, changing an executive officer. That's a big deal for a company, and that investor wants to be able to vote on that. Selling or licensing key assets or intellectual property, same thing. And this, these are things that you can't do without going and getting that investor director to agree to them and getting their opinion and getting their vote in the boardroom. And it kind of guarantees for the investor that you're going to have those conversations. You're not just going to kind of run off with their money and do whatever you want. But it guarantees that they're in the conversation for material things that you're planning for the company.
Leah, we've got a couple of questions on the special investor approval rights. First question is whether the special investor approval rights are negotiable. They are up to a point. You can negotiate that you cannot sell the company without VC investors' approval unless you are selling it for a certain amount, or at least a certain amount. You cannot issue additional shares of stock if it's to someone, if you're issuing stock that's got more rights than the one that they hold. So they're definitely negotiable, but up to a point, obviously.
And you can also make them go away. So if that investor holds less than a certain percentage of the stock that they initially bought, they'll lose their rights. And that's always, that's a good protection. So it's not that they have to continue holding one share of preferred stock and they can hold up a sale of the company.
And then the second question was whether these approval rights apply to angel investing.
And so they often do. It really depends on the type of document the angel is using. So if we're using the SPACE document or the convertible note, those rights won't be negotiated yet. And they'll be deferred to the first venture investment round. But if that angel investor comes into the company and gets any level of preferred stock, they may be asking for special investor rights. It may be a very short list of things they really care about. Almost always the sale of the company is going to be on that list, though. So, and thank you for bringing that to my attention, Danielle, as I was presenting. The next item, this is anti-dilution protection. So, again, we're protecting the value of the investor's investment, and it's essentially an equation or a formula that you apply if the next investment round comes in at a lower valuation. So there's different versions of this. The first is called a full ratchet. A quick example, the investor comes in buying stock at $10 per share, and in 2 years you sell stock at $5 per share. The moment you sell the stock at $5 per share, the amount of stock they own doubles because their new stock purchase price is $5 per share and you need to give them more stock. We have a weighted average, which is a formula which says it depends on how many shares you issued at that lower price. We're going to do a recalculation of what that new per share purchase price is. This is the industry standard. And so one of the problems with full ratchet is, let's say, they bought 1 million shares, and then 2 years later you sell 10 shares. They still get that full change of price. With the weighted average, maybe they'll go down 0.1%, you know, a couple cents. That's kind of the rational thing to do. They didn't have a big effect. They shouldn't get a big windfall from it. And then there's no adjustment at all. You know, they're investing at their risk. If you raise money later at a lower amount, they don't have a protection. Not not that frequent, but definitely the most company-friendly provision that you can get. So if you can get it from a company perspective. And some issuances don't trigger an adjustment, and this is a negotiated list. Standard items are those stock options that you grant to employees, or grants that you might give to a commercial lender in connection with a loan that they give you to buy equipment. There's a fairly standardized list, but you should think about what you plan to do, and we should negotiate, and your attorney should negotiate so that your business plans align with the document.
Some term sheets will have something called participation rights or preemptive rights. This is a right that the investor will expect to have if you're raising new money. They will want the right to purchase their share of whatever new money you're raising whatever new shares you're issuing, so that this way they can maintain their percentage ownership and in the company. There's this concept of pay-to-play, which is a weird name, I think, because it should be more pay if you don't play. Because here, if a preferred stockholder or the investor has certain rights like a board seat, anti-dilution protections, future right to participate in new shares that are being issued, they will lose these rights if the company is raising new funds and they decide not to participate and invest in the new financing round. We typically see this in a down round, which means the valuation is much lower than what it was in the earlier round. This is a company-friendly provision, so you may not see it in the term sheet that you will get from the investor. You probably definitely will not see it from the term sheet presented by an investor. So this is something you want to think about to encourage investors to continue to invest in your company and continue to buy shares in the next round of funding, even if you have a down round, which may happen if the economy there's a slowdown in the economy and you experience some slowdown as well. So it's
really a business term that gets negotiated. It's not something your lawyers throw in and you see how they react, but it's, on the business person perspective, you're going down these conversations of, well, what if this happens? What if that happens? And you talk about, the what ifs and the bad possible scenarios and how the investor is going to manage them. And really, depending on those answers, you can lead them into a pay-to-play provision based on the agreement.
Other terms you may see is something called right of first offer, so that if you decide that you want to sell your shares in the company or another significant stockholder wants to sell, they have to approach the investor and the company and let them know that they are looking to sell. And then the company and the investor are not obligated to purchase, but they have the right to know before you approach any third-party buyer. The right of first refusal is similar, but it allows you to go out and find a buyer, but before you sell, you have to let them know that you have this offer in hand, and then the company or the investor have the right to match it and buy from you.
Right, and there'll be a lot of timelines that are associated with this, so just thinking through what the process is. If you want to sell your stock, will it be 30 days to wait or more than that if you find a buyer? You have to think through how the process works at the negotiation stage for your, what if I want to sell in 2 years or... Yeah.
And then another provision you may see are called information rights, and this is an obligation on the company to provide certain information to the investor, including financial statements on a quarterly basis and an annual basis. Here you want to make sure that, you know, confidentiality is respected, and you don't want to provide this kind of information to more smaller investors or those that could be competitors of the company.
Yeah, and it's just restricting the information of the trade secrets of the company to the smallest group you can. Usually this is a non, this is not a difficult provision to negotiate, but do make sure that you don't overcommit to do a lot of administrative work that will cause you as the small company that should be developing a product so much work in addition to bringing your product to market and making revenue.
And then we get to the last category of terms, and that's the exit provision. So how are these investors going to get their money back? A lot of times investors will negotiate for something called a drag-along right, which is their right to force all of the stockholders to sell their shares if this investor is selling. A lot of times it has to be at a minimum valuation or purchase price, but it's something that they will negotiate to have. Another right they may negotiate for is something called a co-sale right or a tag-along, and that's if you as a founder are looking to sell, they will have the right to tag along and sell with you their pro rata share of whatever you're selling. They may negotiate something called a redemption right, which is their ability to go to the company after so many years and say, look, we need you to redeem our preferred stock at a certain value. And they may negotiate for something called registration rights, which relate to the initial public offering of a company.
Right. And really one of the most important things going into negotiating these exit protections is understanding what the investor coming in expects their exit to look like and when they expect it to happen, because those two information points will really drive what these terms look like when they're negotiated.
And then other things an investor may negotiate are the vesting of the founder shares. So they may say for any shares that you hold that are subject to vesting because once certain conditions are satisfied, they may say that, or even shares that you've actually paid value for or provided services for, they may say that, no, these are going to have to become subject to vesting so that they incentivize you to remain with the company and potentially mitigate future dilution that they may experience. So they may be asking you to do that, restructure your shares. They may ask for a non-compete and non-solicit, which is to restrict you from
competing with the business.
Yeah, leaving the company.
Yeah, if you leave, competing with the business. Other items, making sure you have confidentiality and invention assignment agreements with your employees. If they really are investing in one key person, let's say a brilliant scientist that's, you know, number one in this field, they might make you get a life insurance policy on that key person because they want to be protected if that person's no longer around. But a lot of these other key terms, we can proactively look at what the founders and the company want and set them up in advance the way the company wants. Investors may tweak them a little bit, but if they already exist, they're much more likely to just leave it alone.
And then they may tell you how the funds that they're investing should be used. We talked about the no-shop restriction, confidentiality, and then signatures. As we said, even though you may execute the term sheet, it's still non-binding. But it still has considerable value to you, and it's evidence that you're going to have, hopefully, funding coming in.
Yeah, and as we're closing out the hour, we're going to go a little bit quicker. You signed the term sheet, as Danielle just said. The next thing you do is close the deal. The period of time between signing the term sheet and closing the deal is usually 30 or more days. And the investor is going to have to do due diligence, make sure that everything you verbally told them about the company is actually true, and they're going to look through your documents. You're going to negotiate the documents that reflect the investment terms that you just negotiated in the term sheet. And then you're going to close the deal with one or all of the investors, because you may be closing the deal in tranches. You may not have enough investors to get the amount of money you want to raise. So you may be tranching and closing one investor at a time over a few months period. And then just some quick and final thoughts on this. I'll ask Danielle to go first, since she's usually on the investor side.
Sure. So I know funding is a time-consuming process. It could be somewhat stressful while you're also trying to run your company. But you really got to choose your investors carefully. Do your reference checks on them. If they provide you references to call of other companies they've invested in, do call them. Do ask around about these investors that you're sort of partnering with. It's kind of like a marriage with kids. You're going to be tied to these investors for a long period of time, so you want to make sure you're getting in with the right people.
Great. Making sure you have more than one choice. So if you can get multiple term sheets, you can increase how friendly those term sheets are to the company, because there is competition for the investment in the company. I guess my big point would be, as you're negotiating documents and working with your legal counsel, do reality checks. Figure out what is the most important thing to you. What is the risk of certain things happening in the future? And prioritize those items on which are the most important, let's call them deal killers. If you don't get those in the document, you're not going to do the deal. The things that you can give up or trade for if the investor wants other things. So you should have your list of wants, but you should prioritize how important those are to you in closing the deal and onboarding that investor to your company. So following the webinar, we will send out a copy of the presentation as well as a link to the recording of the audio. And then just going forward, we'll have another Venture Law meetup session next month. We're pushed back into the middle of the month just because of scheduling purposes. But you'll be seeing a mailing about that soon. And if you're in the Cleveland area, I will be speaking at a Generator Lunch and Learn at the end of February on setting financing goals and milestones. So a very similar topic. And one of our co-sponsors, Markham, who's been really kind of key to this series, has a webinar where they feature a different company every single month. And their next spotlight series is coming up on February 21st. So thank you very much for your time and for hanging out with us for four extra minutes. We very much appreciate it.
Thank you.